whom Jesus joins. Mabila was her name.
Whose name?
Ah, yes, I am plunging into this little tale of mine in all too headlong a way.
But you see, my mind is so full of thoughts of a thing of rare beauty that it is inclined to wander somewhat. Oh, it's such a precious jewel, this virtue of holy purity. Surely it is the pearl of great price. Oh, for heaven's sweet sake, I said to some darlings a short time ago, lock up that jewel in the safe of Mary's immaculate, most pure heart. Then the world, the flesh, and the devil, those three merciless thieves, will never be able to get it, never.
But what has this to do with Mabila? And who was she?
Mabila was Edmund's mother, and Edmund was a youth who knew that without the beauteous virtue of holy purity, there can be no other virtues in the soul. He afterwards became the renowned Archbishop of Canterbury. And his was a saintly mother, too, as mothers of saints are wont to be. So when she sent Edmund to Paris, together with his brother Norbert, to pursue his studies there, she earnestly begged of him to be prayerfully careful, and told him of some beautiful practices that would help him preserve his innocence. Edmund arrived at the city. Oh, it was dangerous there! So many bad, dissolute young people everywhere. But what did he do? He locked up his pearl in the safe of Mary's heart. He was wont to call upon her, when even the slightest shade of danger overshadowed him, in thought. Happy boy, how the angels of God must have liked to be near him. One day Edmund happened to be in a room with some other young students, when all at once these began to say nasty things, things that would have endangered his innocence had he listened to them. But he did not listen. He arose in displeasure and abruptly left the room. But scarcely was he outside when a handsome youth met him, a youth whose beauty was more than heavenly, and who straightway began to strengthen and console him with the words of thrilling sweetness. Because you left them, I now join you, the stranger said.
Stranger? Was he?
Edmund looked up into his fair face. There, on his forehead, was written in letters of gold the word Jesus.
I have deceived myself. Isn't it strange, sadly so, to see how little people outside the church worry about personal sin? They try to live up to the conventionalities of life, and are rather careful to avoid all that might, externally at least, interfere with their pursuit of life, health, and happiness. But that is all. How sad! But Henry was a Catholic lad, in name at least, and he should have known that the scoffing world around him was blind, willfully blind, and was not to be listened to nor to be followed. That he did not want to know it is just the reason why he got on the fatal path that leads right down to hell, the path of impure pleasures. Oh, he would say when the priest and others who had his welfare at heart would warn him to leave his wicked ways and turn back to God, these things are not as bad as you try to make me believe. Why, everybody's doing it. It's only natural. And you can't tell me God forbids it, as you say he does. Don't be trying to fool me with that grandma talk. One day, there was a hurried sick call. It was to Henry's home. Father Maurice hastened thither. Too late. When he arrived, Henry was dead. He knelt with the family to pray for the repose of the departed soul. Suddenly, to the horror of all, the head of the lifeless boy moved. His eyes opened. He raised himself slightly, and in a fearful voice that thrilled the kneeling group with fear, he exclaimed, "I have deceived myself." Then he fell back upon the bed, lifeless again. "I have deceived myself.
The priest knew only too well what that meant. Before the judgment seat of God, Henry's eyes had been opened, but it was too late. A warning. They were two brothers. Arthur was 10 years old, and Charles was 15. Arthur was pure and holy, like a snow-white lily, like a shrinking, modest violet. But Charles was given to dark, secret, shameful things. That is why he could not endure his brother so truly good. Was it not a constant reproach to him? Yes. And that is why he tried to teach the younger lad wicked things, things that were not purity, not modesty. That is why, when he found that his brother, despite all hints, advances, suggestions, remained true to God, he resolved to force him into sin. "You three conceal yourselves in that wood over there," he said one morning to three of his companions in vice, "and I will get Arthur to come out with me. Then we'll teach him something, whether he likes it or not." "Sure," they agreed and laughed. There was the devil in that laugh. "Let's take a walk in the woods, Arthur," said Charles a few minutes later. "I want to show you the beautiful squirrels." What a lie it was! But the impure are liars always, because they are the children of the father of liars, the devil. They crossed a meadow. How green it was! The sky was clear and blue. Birds were singing. But as they neared the woods wherein the wicked ones were hiding, dark clouds suddenly hid the sun from sight. There was a fearful flash of lightning and a deafening roar of thunder, and then a second, a third. And Arthur, the innocent lad, stood trembling with fear and awe. Only a few feet from him lay his wicked brother's body, contorted, burnt, and torn, struck dead by terrible thunderbolts from on high. And his soul... Yes, if we be true to God, he will fight for us, even with the lightnings of heaven.
Nothing to laugh at. "Oh, why do you make such a fuss about medals and such like things?" Clara exclaimed impatiently. "Do you really believe that wearing little pieces of metal is going to help you any?" Clara was Rose's friend, but, poor girl, she had become careless and was beginning to laugh at religion. Maybe it was because her father was a non-Catholic. Or was it because of the bad company she did not avoid? "Oh," Rose answered earnestly, rather pained, "they do help, Clara. Why, their very blessing brings a blessing, and the devotion they represent, surely that's a great blessing, too." And then she told Clara this little incident. During the Great World War, a little girl had sent her father, who was at the front, a loving letter. Her father was in the trenches when the letter reached him. As he opened the envelope and pulled out the sheet of paper, a little object fell to the ground. He stooped to pick it up, and just as he stooped, a bullet whistled through the air just where his head had been. A shade of pallor crept over the soldier's face as he realized how chance had saved him, as he thought. But was it chance? He bent down to pick up the object. It was something hard wrapped in tissue paper. He unfolded the paper. In his hand, he held a little medal that his darling girlie had sent him. The Altar Boys at Santarem. Yes, some of you, I'm sure, have heard me tell it, but a good story will bear retelling, won't it? Especially if it's a true, true story, as this one is. It happened in Portugal, in a city called Santarem, in the year 1265. That was almost 700 years ago, wasn't it? Yes, and it happened just like this. Listen. At Santarem, there lived at that time a saintly priest called Father Bernard. He was a Dominican priest, a religious, what you of this day and land would call a missionary priest.
There he lived, but not alone. Many other priests lived in the monastery with him. So, of course, many masses were said every morning. And where many masses are said, why, there many must be served, you know. Now, there were two wonderful boys in that city, holy boys, as pure as angels and as good as, oh, I don't know what. Every morning they were up bright and early and on their way to the monastery to serve at Mass. There they would wait on the priests at Mass so devoutly as to edify everybody, especially at Father Bernard's Mass. You should have seen Pedro and Juan, that is what they were always called, at the altar, like cherubs. Ah, their hands were always nicely folded, their eyes fixed on the priest. There was no playing with their fingers, no moving restlessly about on their knees, no making of genuflections with such haste as almost to fall over oneself and all that. No, they were little models, and that is why Jesus left his mother's arms to come to them. Oh, did he do that? Yes. How? Just be patient. Pedro and Juan always brought a bit of breakfast, some bread and a little fruit, with them, because they had to stay at the monastery so long. This they would then eat in a tiny side chapel where the Blessed Sacrament was not kept. Now, near the place where they used to sit down, there was a statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary holding the boy Jesus in her arms. One day, as they passed this statue, the darling child miraculously bent down and asked them to let him share their meal. Were the boys surprised, and did they try to run away, afraid? No, no, they were too good, too used to being in the presence of God, for that. All they did was to beam with joy and to give him 100,000 welcomes. Of course you may come, dearest Jesus. We will be only too glad to give you everything and to let you be with us every single day. Yes, oh Jesus, do come. And just think of it. Jesus left his holy mother's arms and sat between the boys and ate of their bread and their fruit. How he must love good altar boys. And now that wonderful thing happened not only once, but many times. Jesus loves to be with angelic children. And tell me, are not good altar boys who always kneel among the crowds of angels that surround the Blessed Sacrament, especially during Holy Mass, visible angels? Well, they ought to be. Why, next to the priest, they are the nearest to God, to the Blessed Sacrament. And next to the priest, they get the most graces and blessings, too, if only they behave as they should. Yes, to come back to my story. There was Jesus away from his mother's arms, and so chummy with those boys. Soon the lads could keep the beautiful secret no longer. They told the whole story to Father Bernard. You can imagine how the dear priest thanked God for such a favor. Then he made a request. But boys, why do you not ask Jesus to invite you to dine with him also? Sweetly beg of him to return the invitation, and include me also. Oh, we never thought of that. We were so happy, said the lads. But we will do it, Father, tomorrow. So the next day, when the child Jesus sat between the two youngsters again, they begged of him to let them dine with him, too. And not only we would like to do so, but Father Bernard also, they added. And that is just what I have been longing for you to ask, beautiful boys. The infant gave answer in a sweet, sweet voice. Because you are so good, you and your Father Bernard shall dine with me in my Father's kingdom. And he told them to be ready on Ascension Day. Oh, how fervently Father Bernard and the boys prepared for that mysterious banquet! And when the great day came, the priest celebrated Mass with all the burning love of a seraph. The boys kneeling on both sides like two glowing cherubs. And after Mass was over, they knelt down at the foot of the altar, and overcome by the intensity of their love, they prostrated themselves on the altar steps and fell into a sweet, gentle sleep, the sleep of death. And then was accomplished in them just what Jesus had promised, as it is written in the Holy Bible.
And I dispose to you, as my father hath disposed to me, a kingdom, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom. St. Luke, chapter 22, verses 29 and 30. Ah, the beauty of it all! After Mass, Jesus had always taken lunch with the boys. That morning, the boys dined with Jesus in heaven, as he had promised them. What a reward! What a fine thing it is to be good, fine on earth, and finer in heaven! Can't I do something for you, Papa? Yes, Marie was a dear little girl of just 10 summers. She was kind and gentle to everybody, and her large brown eyes were all full of loving helpfulness. Really, I believe she knew as well as I do that God takes special delight in looking upon boys and girls that are obedient and meek and humble of heart. Now this gentleness of Marie's made her so obedient and willing to help that she could read a request in Mama's eyes or Papa's or sister's almost any time one was there. She would not even wait to be asked if she could help it. One evening, when Papa came back from work, tired and rather out of sorts, and was sitting at his desk reading the paper, Marie softly went up to his side. Why? Because, you see, her love and her desire to be a little angel of charity and to make others happy sent her thither. Yes, there she stood. Then she lightly touched Papa's arm and said in her soft musical voice, "Can't I do something for you, Papa?" Papa turned and looked at her. At first he did not understand. He was so tired and worn out. "What do you mean, Marie?" he asked. "Can't I get you something or make you comfortable and happy in some way, Papa? For I love you so." Then he understood. This little one, for whom he was working so hard, wanted to help along by her willingness. Her eyes lighted up. "Of course you can, darling," he cried as he took her into his arms. "You can give me one big loving kiss, and I thank God over and over again for having given me the precious girlie that you are, my own Marie. Oh, if little people only knew how they can make a heaven out of home by being bits of sunshine and sweetness and obedient helpfulness always." Preserve your white necktie. Once upon a time, maybe when your papa was a little boy or your mama a little girl, there was a lad going to college in the city of Rennes, France. He was a remarkably good fellow, George was, very much like those boys we read about in the lives of the saints. Always at the head of his class in school, he was likewise ahead of most boys in church and at home. In church he was pious and devout, a lover of prayer and piety, and a giver of good example. At home he was sweet-mannered and helpful and kind and loving to everybody. That's the kind of a boy George was. His father and mother, brothers and sisters, relatives and friends must have been very proud of him. It was while going to this college that George made his first Holy Communion. On the day preceding that happy event, the Reverend Rector, according to a beautiful custom that prevailed there, invited each of the boys to make some written resolution regarding future conduct, and to hand it to him for safekeeping. All the lads did so. George did so too. And this was what he wrote: "I promise always to wear the white necktie of my first Holy Communion day, and to place it aside only in case I should have the misfortune to commit a mortal sin." The rector naturally was rather surprised at this odd resolution, and asked George if he wouldn't change it, if he wouldn't try to find some other. The boy, however, said he would rather not. That was his resolve, and he would keep it. His mother was summoned to the college to try to change his son's mind, but so sweetly and well did he talk it over with her that she joyfully permitted him to have it out his way. The next day George received Jesus into his heart for the first time, and after that tiny white wafer of what seems to be bread but is really and truly the body and blood of Christ, had been placed on his eager tongue, he whispered again to that gracious guest, "Jesus, I will keep my white necktie always for you." 2 weeks had passed, and George was wearing his white necktie still. All the other boys had placed theirs aside long ago. They thought it funny that he should keep his on, so they began to tease him. "Say, George, you forgot to take off your white necktie. Gracious, but you must be studying day and night to forget a thing like that," they said with friendly banter, for everybody thought the world of him. Then George told them why he was keeping it on and about the resolution he had made. After that, they never said another word. They now thought more than the world of their saintly comrade. That necktie was telling the fair story of sanctifying grace. Years passed. The short but bloody Franco-Prussian War broke out. One day the Prussians managed to occupy a dangerously strong position at Mons. They had to be dislodged. A brave little detachment of French soldiers, 300 in number, was sent to do it, and they did it. But of those brave 300, 200 were killed or wounded in the doing. After the battle, the Reverend Chaplain was hastening about among the wounded and the dying, administering the consolations of religion, when he came upon a young man who was very near the end. "Would you like to go to confession?" gently said the priest, bending low over the bleeding form. "No," said the youth with a happy smile that showed how little he was afraid to die. "I made my last confession only 3 days ago, and have nothing to confess. Just place me on the grass, Father, and give me the last sacraments. And, Father," he murmured, "may I ask another favor of you? You see this white necktie? On the day of my first Holy Communion, I promised never to lay it aside unless I should stain my soul with mortal sin. I have kept my white necktie, dear Father. Prayer and the sacraments and devotion to the Blessed Mother of God have enabled me to keep it, Father." The voice grew weaker. "Tell Mother it was never stained except by the blood that I shed for my country." It was George. From that field of battle, his pure soul sped away to God. Preserve your white necktie. Why obey? Why obey? What a question, and yet it falls from rebellious little lips only too often. So I will tell you a story to show what a wise and pious prince thought of obedience. Here's what he thought. "He who will not obey those whom God has placed over him, be they parents, teachers, guardians, or other superiors, will not obey God himself." How true! For if you think it over, you'll see that we obey God in them. Now for the story. The young Prince of Wales had a very good private teacher, a governess, but one morning he flatly refused to study his lessons. "Either you will study your lesson, or stand over there in that corner for half an hour," said the governess. After all, other means had failed. "I will neither study my lessons, nor will I stand over there in that corner," answered the young prince proudly. Finding she could do nothing with the boy, the governess informed his father of the matter. Prince Albert entered the room. "Sit down on that chair," said he, "until I return." He soon came back with the Holy Bible in his hand, and from its pages read to his disobedient son the oft-quoted words, "Who spares the rod, spoils the child." Thereupon he gave the lad a sound thrashing. "Now," he said, "when your teacher bade you either to study or to stand in the corner, you would do neither the one nor the other. You will, therefore, now both stand in that corner and study your lessons there until the governess sees fit to release you. And remember, my son, that young people who do not obey God in their superiors will neither obey him in himself when they are grown up." A beautiful legend of Corpus Christi. One fine morning in the month of June, old Mother Birch Tree told her children not to be a bit frightened should someone come in the course of a few hours and cut them down. "Yours may be a glorious lot," she said, "but only the fine, tall, straight trees will be taken. Listen, my children, it may be your happiness to stand honorary guard when the Lord Jesus moves in triumph through the streets on the feast of Corpus Christi tomorrow. It is indeed true that afterwards you will have to die, but you will see that which is the most beautiful on the face of God's earth, and you will be giving your lives for Him. I could not see Him when I was young, because I have grown crooked." And Mother Birch sobbed. Nearly all the young birches were delighted with the prospect. Only a few tried to hide themselves, faint-heartedly, behind their mother. The others were only proud of the honor that might be accorded them, and looked forward with joy to the hour of their glorious sacrifice. After having seen that which is fairest under the sun, they said to each other, "We can afford to die, for then a nameless longing would consume us, and we would die slow deaths anyhow. As it is, we shall die like so many martyrs." Now one tiny little birch heard all this too, but it was too frail, too small, too gentle, a mere baby birch. And when it hesitatingly asked whether it would probably be taken also, the others only looked sympathetic and shook their leaves most doubtfully. Then the little birch became very sad indeed. Not even its mother, nor the sunshine, nor the birds that sang so jubilantly in its branches every morning, could console it in its sorrow. "To see the Lord Jesus! Oh, the twinkling stars up above its head so high had told it so much about this dear, good God. When the others were asleep, it used to listen to their wonderful talk for a long, long time, to adorn the way along which He would walk, to see Him, to die for Him. What an enviable lot!" Suddenly the tread of heavy feet was heard, and rough voices sounded. Ah, surely many of the youthful birches, so brave but a moment before, must have trembled then, even in spite of themselves. But they were quickly cut down, one after the other. With pain and yet joy did Mother Birch Tree look upon her children as they fell before her very eyes. Theirs was to be a happy lot indeed. "Oh, if they would only come to me," the weak little birch sobbed in a whisper. "Enough," called out one of the voices, so it was not to be taken along after all. Oh, how it had hoped against hope that it would be needed anyhow! A dewdrop ran down its fair white trunk like a tear. "One is still wanting," a voice said again, "but there is not a single nice tree left." "Ah, here, this one will do." A blow, a fall, and the little birch, happy in its very pain and all aglow, was piled onto the wagon with the rest. It is the great feast of Corpus Christi. All in a row the birches stand proudly side by side along the flower-covered road, young and fresh and smiling in their bliss, each beauteous leaf trembling in adoration. The favored guard of honor of the Lord God, Jesus, in the Blessed Sacrament, to be adored forever. Where is our little birch, the blessed one? Oh, the good fortune that fell to its lot! In addition to other larger and leafier trees, two smaller ones were wanted in order the more symmetrically to adorn the high altar in the open. They were placed just next to the tabernacle, and one of them was our thrice-happy little birch. Oh, how long it seems before the Eucharistic King comes! Now the last gospel is being read, and lo, the procession enters. First the little girls, dressed in white, with wreaths upon their hair, looking for all the world like angels. Then the priests in their gold-embroidered vestments. And then, beneath the starry baldachin, the venerable bishop reverently bearing the most blessed sacrament. The little birch sees the Lord at once. It cannot turn its eyes away from Him, the God of all, whom the stars spoke about in those holy night watches, and whose delight it is to be with the children of men under the humble appearances of bread. He has come to the altar at last. The little birch can see him from very near, and oh, what a trembling passes through it from head to foot when the bishop places the golden monstrance upon the altar of spotless white, and its branches touch the glowing gems. Now it will die gladly, oh, so gladly. It has seen that which is the most beautiful upon the face of God's blessed earth, Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. The Te Deum is intoned. All join in, and the mighty volume of sound jubilantly ascends on high. So it must be in heaven, where the saints and angels sing the praises of God. Such melodies must be in the hearts of those whose constant prayer is this: Thy Eucharistic kingdom come. But the little birch was dead. Too great had been its happiness. It had died of joy. The others still stood proudly there, fresh and strong. But baby birch let its leaves hang pitifully low. Its withered branches drooped as they leaned lightly against the tabernacle, a touching symbol of love clinging in death to the Lord whom it had so joyously clung to in life. The Black Night. It was evening. The setting sun that summer day looked down upon a different world from the one we know, yet the same. Newspapers, telephones, telegraphy, wireless and otherwise, and the thousand and one ways and means of the 20th century communication had not even been dreamt of then. Had they been part and parcel of everyday existence as they are now, they would have been conquering space and overcoming time and hurling across the continent the news of the mighty deeds of the chivalrous and romantic King of England, Richard I, the Lion-hearted. Engaged in a holy crusade, he had just defeated the famous Saracen general Saladin at the memorial battle of Ascalon, in which 40,000 followers of the Crescent were slain. Henry VI was the ruler of Germany in those strange days, days of fair knightly valor indeed, but of deeds of deepest, darkest treachery too. It was evening, and in an open space in one of the rugged forests that ranged along the castled Rhine strode the Black Knight. He had laid his heavy armor aside. As he paced to and fro, eager desire was depicted on his features, mingled with an occasional gleam of half-savage light that betokened a something akin to desperation. Suddenly, out of the densest of the neighboring thickets, there came another knight, grim, weird, silent, dark. Over his shoulders was thrown a mantle of the freshest blood-red. "Sire," said he, as he halted the Black Knight in the feverish walk, "Sire, wherefore this solitary pacing alone?" "What?" was the knight's answer. "Art thou a stranger in these parts, that thou knowest not of tomorrow's happenings at Goldstein Castle, where rules the Duke of Leoforte?" "Nay, for how should I know, sire, having come to these parts but yestereve?" "List then, friend, hear the cause of my retreat hither. And if thou canst aid with good advice, assuredly will I reward thee highly." "I seek no reward," the stranger rejoined. "Speak." "Tomorrow," said the Black Knight, "even at the vesper hour, there shall be a ducal tournament at the castle yonder. The knights from all the country round shall be there to vie each with the other in feats of strength and skill. And when all awards shall have been duly meted out, with the bravest of the brave shall assemble together with their bows and their arrows, and the archers' contest shall take place. And hearken, stranger, to him who pierces the clover leaf shall be given the land of the Duke's youngest daughter, the fair and comely Bernice. For that treasure I would gladly give my all. I love her with a passionate love, and I am here because I must win on the morrow, and in this evening air must make sure that the prize escape me not." "And if it escape thee, friend, what then?" What then? The Black Knight's eyes gleamed in impotent fear and fury. It may not escape me, man. For that prize I would sell my very soul thrice over.
From somewhere there came a hideous, mocking laugh. The stranger with the blood-red mantle drew near, so near that his hot breath fanned the Black Knight's cheek as he grated into his ear. Thou wouldst have my advice. List. I can tell thee how to make thy aim as unerring as the thunderbolt that is hurled from on high to strike the rebellious blasphemer down. Come. With that he took the Black Knight by the arm, and they strode to a neighboring vale. The stranger pointed to an object beneath a clump of trees. It was a wayside crucifix erected by the piety of the faithful. Upon a rude cross of hewn oak hung a wooden figure of the God-man in his agony. "Dost thou see that?" he asked in the strangest of whispers. "The cross, thou meanest?" At that word the stranger shrank back and seemed to cower to the earth. "Yes," he said, turning his face away with nervous twitchings. "Friend, let that be the target for thy practice on the morrow morn. The arrow that thrice shall pierce that image shall win the hand of the fair Bernice." As mysteriously as he had come, the stranger disappeared. Long the Black Knight pondered. The arrow that thrice should strike the crucified, that arrow should win? Heated passion would be sated only if thrice he struck it. It? What? God? Or the image of his God? Deep into the night he pondered on. And when morning dawned, he took his powerful bow into his hand, and chose an arrow straight and strong, and placing himself at a fair distance from the wayside crucifix, he stretched the bow and sent the arrow flying through the air. It struck the head of the crucified. There was a hollow sound, then an ominous silence. In the surrounding forest, the morning breeze seemed strangely to moan and to wail. Again the Black Knight placed the arrow to the string, and again he sent it flying through space. There was a dull, lifeless sound as it struck the feet of the crucified. And even then a low groan came from somewhere. The Black Knight staggered and paled. "Once more," he muttered hoarsely, "and she will be mine." And for the third time the fatal arrow was hurled toward the image by the sinewy bough. It struck. This time it entered the wound in the side of the crucified. For one breathless moment the very heart of nature seemingly ceased to beat. Cold sweat stood upon the Black Knight's brow, as with trembling hand he pulled the arrow from the wound. And as he drew it back, lo, there gushed forth a stream of purple blood, and the eyes of the crucified opened and looked upon him in unspeakable reproach. Then a lightning flash came from the highest heavens, and the Black Knight stood in the midst of an awful flame. And even as it struck him down, the stranger in the blood-red mantle rushed from somewhere and seized him in a grip of steel, and the earth opened wide at the terrific crash of the thunderbolt's roar, and the two were swallowed up in the dark abyss that yawned below. All was quiet, and it seemed as though nothing had happened. At the foot of the crucifix, the grass and the flowers were growing even as before. Birds were singing in the trees that sheltered it. An awful thing had come to pass, but it had left no sign behind it. But no, at the foot of the crucifix lay an arrow. Blood had trickled from its point and down along the shaft, and even as it had flowed it had written two words, which words were the arrow's name. And the words were, "Mortal Sin." The Wonderful Remedy. Have you ever heard of the Zambezi River? It is in Africa, the dark continent,
where so many millions of black people are still waiting to learn about the one true God, in whom we, thanks forever to the goodness of the Savior, happily believe. Well, Father John Lube, a missionary priest, began the holy labors of an apostle on that mighty river's banks. There were hardships to be endured, numerous obstacles to be overcome. Of course there were. It is ever so in all apostolic undertakings. But despite the scorching heat of that torrid climate, despite the more than uncomfortable prowling of blood-thirsty leopards and other beasts of prey, Father John persevered in his arduous task of saving those poor, abandoned souls. And soon, to his great joy, he had a fine little Christian congregation, and those who were not yet of the household of the faith were beginning to look with greater favor upon the Church of Christ. Especially were the little black children a source of consolation to him, and their fervor and evident delight in coming often to receive our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament filled his heart with sweetest joy, for he knew, as I know too, that Holy Communion is the great antidote of sin. On a certain day, one of the Christian lads, Stephen was his name, came to him and said, "Father dear, the chiefs of our tribe say that you have a wonderful remedy against immodesty. The Christian children love and cherish holy purity above all things. They never say anything indecent. They never sing bad songs. But they like to sing beautiful religious hymns. The chiefs say that they get the good medicine when they approach the altar rail in the morning." "Of course I have such a remedy," said Father John with a pleased smile. "And Stephen, my boy, I'm sure you know what it is, too. Now tell me, what are the great safeguards for the pearl of virtues for holy purity?" "Avoidance of bad companions, devotion to our dear lady, and the frequent reception of Holy Communion," answered Stephen quickly. "Yes, and especially Holy Communion," said Father John. "It is the bread of pure souls, the food that makes virgins, the great antidote against sin, particularly against the sin of immodesty. Oh, Stephen, if only everybody would come to partake of the remedy often, how happy they would be in the possession of the priceless treasure of holy purity." "Oh, Father dear," cried Stephen, "preach about this wonderful remedy tomorrow when the heathens come to the mission. Tell them that the chieftains are right, that you have such a medicine, that if only they become Christians, they might have it every day." "I surely will, my boy," said Father John, patting the pious lad's woolly head. "I surely will." And he did. Thereafter, he made more Christians still, and his own little flock gathered more frequently than ever at the table of the Lord. Oh, if we only knew how Jesus hungers and thirsts to be received by us, his poor little creatures. If we only knew what a wonderful help, what an unfailing remedy it is in fighting the battle that we all must fight to keep unstained the pearl of virtues. Then we would come to Holy Communion often, often, oh, so often, every day.
You will hear more stories from Tell Us Another on the next tape.